Welcome. You are listening to AfterSight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Hello and welcome to the Black Experience Hour. This is a weekly program. This one is being recorded for the listening week that begins May 18th. Your reader's name is Susan Shirey. Opening this week, readings from TheRoot.com, including an obituary for a Dr. King ally, Reverend William Lawson, followed by two articles related to Biden's upcoming Morehouse commencement speech, and following that, two articles on some teens deserving of recognition here at the end of the school year. Following that, depending on time, we will turn to other sources, including The Washington Post, New York Times, CPR News, and possibly also, PBS, Rocky Mountain PBS. But first, from TheRoot.com, this is written by Angela Johnson. It was posted on the 15th, Three things we'll remember about MLK's ally, the late Reverend William Lawson. Wheeler Avenue Baptist Church pastor, Reverend William Lawson, died at age 95. The people of Houston, Texas, are mourning the loss of one of its most beloved spiritual leaders. Reverend William Lawson passed away on Wednesday, May 14th, at age 95. Along with leading his congregation at Wheeler Avenue Baptist Church, Lawson was a dedicated servant to the greater community of Houston, a staunch civil rights advocate, and a close friend of Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. He was integral in helping desegregate the city and continued to serve the community long after he stepped away from the pulpit. In a 2018 interview with Houston's NBC affiliate, Lawson described the legacy he hoped to leave behind. Quote, "I simply hope I would have been faithful to what the gospel is," he said. He went on, "And the gospel speaks of feeding the poor and clothing the naked. If I have been faithful to that, I'll be glad to be perceived that way." End quote. Wheeler Avenue Baptist Church posted an announcement of Lawson's passing on its website. The statement read, quote, "He has completed his time of service here on earth and is now enjoying eternal rest." End quote. He was Houston's pastor. Although he was born in St. Louis, Missouri, William Lawson was lovingly referred to as, quote, "Houston's pastor." He came to the city in the mid-1950s at age 27 to take a position as the director of the Baptist Student Union at Texas Southern University. While there, he also served as the school's chaplain. In 1962, he founded Wheeler Avenue Baptist Church in Houston's Third Ward, where he remained pastor for 42 years. Lawson started the church in his living room with only 13 members, but over time he nurtured Wheeler Avenue Baptist into a thriving staple of the community that currently has over 12,000 members. Lawson also reached out to religious leaders of other faiths across Houston. He worked so closely in the community with Rabbi Samuel Karf and Archbishop Joseph Fiorenza that the trio became known as the Three Amigos. His wife encouraged him to become an activist. According to Lawson, his commitment to using his church for activism was inspired by Audrey, his wife of 62 years. A social worker who worked closely with young people in Houston, Audrey Lawson made it her mission to ensure that Wheeler Avenue Baptist was an integral part of the community. She launched programming such as Boys and Girl Scout troops, a preschool, and an infant care center at the church before she passed in 2015. Reverend Lawson said, "Audrey told him he had a responsibility to the community beyond the pulpit." Quote, "I thought of that church as basically a church where we would preach the gospel," he said in an interview. Audrey was the person who said, quote, "You're in a neighborhood that's in great need, and you just can't, pardon me, that's, and you can't just preach the gospel," end quote. He was a close friend of Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. Reverend Lawson was a key figure in Houston's civil rights movement and played an important role in helping desegregate the city. He worked tirelessly to establish resources to help some of the city's most vulnerable, including constructing affordable housing for senior citizens and establishing a public defender program for those unable to afford legal representation. He became a close friend of Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr., hosting him when he came to Houston and opening the doors of his church to King when other black pastors would not, because the FBI had wrongly labeled him as a communist. Lawson also helped launch the Houston office of King's Southern Christian Leadership Conference. Next article was published April 26th, written by Nigel Roberts. Black men might turn their backs, literally, on President Biden's Morehouse commencement speech. The HBCU's invitation faces backlash from many students, alum, and faculty. Democratic presidents delivering graduation commencement addresses at HBCUs are typically good vibe moments, but that's not the case this time. Strong opposition is brewing against President Joe Biden's invitation to deliver the May 24th keynote speech at iconic all-male HBCU, Morehouse College in Atlanta. Morehouse, which extended the invitation in September, received immediate backlash after announcing Biden's keynote address. Many complained that Morehouse is a merely political pawn in Biden's re-election bid, nothing more than a campaign stop in the crucial swing state of Georgia. Polls predict that disgruntled young black men could turn their backs on Biden and the Democratic Party on Election Day. And the way things are looking, black men in caps and gowns at Morehouse could literally turn their backs to him in protest on graduation day. Martin Luther King Jr.'s alma mater is one of only two commencement invitations that Biden accepted. The United States Military Academy at West Point is the other, among what is likely dozens of invites. Given the polling data, cynics say it's unsurprising that the White House accepted an invitation to address the graduating class, since the chance for TV news soundbites is tantalizing. Quote, $100 says commencement address morphs into campaign speech where President Biden talks about what he's going to do about the two key pieces of voting registration that has languished in the Senate since 2021, end quote. Instagram user commented. Opponents also criticized Morehouse's plan to present Biden with an honorary doctorate. Quote, speaking here is cool, I guess, but giving the man who drafted the 94 crime bill an honorary degree from Morehouse is crazy, end quote, wrote a Quinn.zip. Indeed, many black folks have not forgiven Biden for sponsoring the 1994 crime law as a senator that criminal justice reform activists blame for the wave of mass incarcerations of black men in the 1990s. This is all playing out against the backdrop of widespread protests against Biden on university campuses over his support of Israel in its war against Hamas terrorists in Gaza, where Palestinian civilians face a humanitarian crisis. Opponents have dubbed the president, quote, Genocide Joe, including former Morehouse professor Mark Lamont Hill. White House Press Secretary Karen Jean-Pierre addressed the backlash at a press conference on Wednesday. A reporter asked if Biden had any concern about Morehouse disinviting him. Quote, I'm certainly not going to speculate or go into hypotheticals, Jean-Pierre responded. The president is certainly looking forward to these two commencements, and he's done these many times before. Understanding the important moment and how special that moment is for the graduates and their families. And he's going to do his best to meet that moment as it relates to what's going on, the pain that communities are feeling. End quote. There's no chance of the college rescinding the invitation, Morehouse's provost and senior vice president of academic affairs, Kendrick Brown, told fuming faculty members, according to The Guardian. Still, Morehouse political science professor Andrew Douglas told NBC News that several faculty members refused to, quote, sit on a stage with Joe Biden. With university protests spreading, there is concern for student safety. Quote, our priority should be to try and ensure that under no circumstances are the police brought to bear on our students, said Douglas. He went on, our students do not have the same privileges that Ivy League students typically do, and confrontations with the police can turn deadly for our students. End quote. Next, written by Kaylin Womack, published on the 16th. Ahead of Biden's commencement speech, here are some famous Morehouse graduates. Called the Black Harvard, the famous HBCU, trained and polished thousands of impressive Morehouse men, such as MLK, Raphael Warnock, Bakari Sellers, and more. I will read from the slideshow. Samuel L. Jackson. The acting legend was expelled from the college in 1969 after holding Martin Luther King Sr. hostage in a protest for 2 days. However, he returned later and graduated with a degree in drama in 1972. Raphael Warnock. The minister and Georgia senator graduated with a Bachelor of Arts in Psychology from Morehouse in 1991. Martin Luther King, Sr. The father of civil rights giant Martin Luther King, Jr. graduated from the college in 1929 with a bachelor's degree in theology. He later served on the school's board and subject to a student protest demanding school curriculum reform. Martin Luther King, Jr. The civil rights leader graduated from the college in 1948 with a Bachelor of Arts degree in sociology. During his time there, he began encouraging students and organizations to make a movement out of fighting for racial justice. Martin Luther King III. The civil rights leader's son and activist graduated from the college with a bachelor's degree in political science in 1979. Bakari T. Sellers. The son of an iconic civil rights activist, Bakari, the handsome young civil rights attorney, CNN analyst, best-selling author, and politician from South Carolina, graduated from the college with a Bachelor of Arts degree in 2005. John David Washington. The actor and son of acting legend Denzel Washington was a football player at the college and signed to the St. Louis Rams as an undrafted free agent soon after graduating in 2006. Julian Bond. The civil rights activist attended Morehouse after moving down to Atlanta in the 1960s. However, he left briefly to participate in an anti-segregation protest with the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. When he returned, he graduated with a bachelor's in English in 1971. Spike Lee. The film directing legend and screenwriter graduated from the college in 1979 with a Bachelor of Arts in Mass Communications. Brian Tyree Henry. The actor graduated from the college in the class of 2004 with a major in business. before going on to get his master's in drama at Yale. Howard Thurman. The Christian philosopher and educator received his bachelor's degree from the college in 1923 and returned later for tenure as the school's director of religious life. And I'll stop at that point, which is about halfway through their slideshow, moving on to the articles about the teens. Still reading from theroot.com. This one was published by Angela Johnson on the 14th. Black Chicago girl who went to college at 10 just earned another amazing feat. The Chicago teen is the youngest student to earn a doctoral degree in integrated behavioral health from ASU. A Chicago teen now has an impressive title to add to her name, Doctor. Dr. Dorothy Jean Tillman II just earned her doctoral degree from Arizona State University at age 17. Tillman's impressive academic journey began when she entered the College of Lake County as a psychology major at age 10. Soon after, she followed up with her Master's of Science from Unity College. When she was 15, Tillman started the Doctor of Behavioral Health Management program at Arizona State University. 2 years later, Tillman defended her dissertation and earned her doctoral degree in integrated behavioral health from ASU's College of Health Solutions, an achievement that makes her the youngest person in school history to earn a doctoral degree in integrated behavioral health. In an interview with Good Morning America, Tillman said she owes her love of learning to her grandmother, who always stressed the importance of education, even beyond what is taught in the classroom. Quote, "It doesn't just have to be all of the subjects that they teach you in school. There are so many things in the world to learn about that we wish we knew about," she said. "I feel like that urge to learn something new just never didn't exist for me." End quote. Dr. Leslie Manson, a clinical associate professor at ASU, describes Tillman as, quote, "inquisitive and intelligent," and says her work ethic and dedication is an inspiration to other students. Quote, "She has innovative ideas and motivation, which is wonderful," Manson told GMA. "And truly, I think what is inspiring is that she embodies that meaning of being a true leader," end quote. Now that she's completed her PhD, Tillman says she's still trying to figure out her next move, but she knows she has plenty of time. Next article, also written by Angela Johnson. It was published on the 15th. President Joe Biden shouted out a graduating black teen who landed this unbelievable amount of scholarship money. Madison Crowell set out to inspire other young people from rural parts of the South. A Georgia teen and her family will have plenty to celebrate at her high school graduation this year. Madison Crowell, a senior at Liberty County High School in Hinesville, Georgia, was accepted at 231 colleges and universities across the country and received $14.7 million in scholarships. In the fall, Crowell will join the incoming freshman class at High Point University, HPU, in High Point, North Carolina, on a full scholarship. Majoring in exercise sciences, she hopes to eventually complete a doctorate in physical therapy. Crowell, the vice president of her class, a varsity cheerleader, a National Honors Society member, managing editor of the school yearbook, and the lead basketball manager, said, "Choosing HPU to continue her education was one of the best decisions of her life." Quote, "The atmosphere that HPU had when I stepped on campus for the first time was unmatched," she said in a statement. "I felt that I was at home and could spend the next 4 years of my life happily getting an amazing education. I cannot wait to see what HPU has in store for me and the rest of my journey," end quote. The administration at High Point University is looking forward to welcoming Crowell on campus in the fall and believes she will go on to do great things. Quote, She is going to do exceptional things right here at the Premier Life Skills University, where we call everybody to be extraordinary, end quote, said college president Dr. Nido Cubain, pardon me, went on. The sky is not the limit for her, and when she comes to High Point University, we know she'll be a leader. We know she'll make amazing things happen, pardon me. We're here to resource her, cheer her on, and celebrate her victory, end quote. At a May 1st awards ceremony, Crowell even got a shout-out from President Joe Biden, who, in a statement, called Crowell one of the reasons he was, quote, so optimistic about the future. In an interview with Good Morning America, Crowell said she decided to apply to so many schools to show other young people from rural parts of the South that opportunities exist well outside of their hometowns. The next article I archived from the Washington Post back in April. It was published April 27th, written by Ari Berman, from their Retropolis section. Some history. The formerly enslaved lawmaker who warned about rewriting black history. And it's a photo of him underneath the caption says, an engraving of John Roy Lynch, circa 1884. He was 25 when he became the first black member of Congress from Mississippi. A note, this article is adapted from Minority Rule, the right-wing attack on the will of the people and the fight to resist it, which was published by Farrar, Strauss, and Giroux. More than a century before the backlash to the post-George Floyd racial reckoning produced book bans and restrictions on black history curriculums, a pioneering black lawmaker wrote a landmark critique of white historians' attempt to rewrite the narrative of the Reconstruction era. In 1913, John Roy Lynch published The Facts of Reconstruction, one of the first histories of the era written by a black leader who participated in the South's transformation after the Civil War. In the book, Lynch recounted his improbable life story. Born into slavery on a plantation in Louisiana, he was freed by the Emancipation Proclamation in 1863 and moved to Natchez, Mississippi, where he received an informal education by overhearing the lessons from a local white school across the alley from his job at a photography store. In 1870, at the age of 22, he joined Mississippi's first integrated legislature, helping ratify the 14th and 15th Amendments, which guaranteed equal citizenship to formerly enslaved people and voting rights to black men. In 1873, the 24-year-old Lynch became Speaker of the Mississippi House, the first black man to hold that position in any state. A year later, he made history again, becoming the first black member of the U.S. House from Mississippi. He helped pass the last of Congress's major civil rights bills during Reconstruction, banning discrimination in hotels, on trains, and in all public accommodations. It was the high water mark of black political power in the state. African Americans comprised more than 40% of the legislature and held the offices of Lieutenant Governor, Secretary of State, and Secretary of Education. As black influence grew in the majority black state, outnumbered white residents resorted to increasingly extreme tactics to regain power. In 1875, segregationists took back the state by force, forming militia groups that attacked integrated political meetings and kept black voters from the polls. Lynch lost his seat in Congress a year later when Democratic election officials invalidated nearly 5,000 votes cast for him. Then came the revisionism. The histories of the era written by Lynch's white contemporaries described the period as a tragic farce, not because multiracial democracy had been overturned so violently and abruptly, but because it had been attempted at all. Black Southerners were portrayed as ignorant and corrupt, undeserving of the benefits of citizenship, and easily duped by greedy Northern, quote, carpetbaggers, and conniving Southern, quote, scalawags. Lynch wrote, "The facts of Reconstruction after leaving Mississippi and settling in Chicago to counteract this weaponization of history." Quote, "Very much, of course, has been written and published about Reconstruction, but most of it is superficial and unreliable, and, besides, nearly all of it has been written in such a style and tone as to make the alleged facts related harmonize with what was believed to be demanded by public sentiment," he wrote. End quote. His goal was to present the other side. Today, a debate over the country's racial history is again raging, as one recent leading candidate for the 2024 Republican presidential nomination didn't mention slavery among the causes of the Civil War, and another restricted how black history could be taught. 74 laws have been passed at the state level since 2021 limiting how race, sex, and gender are taught in schools, a Washington Post investigation found. These kinds of fights date back more than a century to the critiques of Reconstruction that formed the first serious histories of the era. In the late 1880s, James Ford Rhodes, an Ohio industrialist turned amateur historian, began publishing his highly popular 7-volume History of the United States from the Compromise of 1850 to the Final Restoration of Home Rule at the South in 1877. That was the title. He wrote, quote, "No large policy in our country has ever been so conspicuous a failure as that of forcing universal Negro suffrage upon the South," end quote. He referred to Reconstruction as the, quote, "oppression of the South by the North," end quote. Lynch critiqued Rhodes's work in a series of articles in the Journal of Negro History in 1917 and 1918, following publication of The Facts of Reconstruction. Quote, "I regret to say that, so far as the Reconstruction period is concerned, it is not only inaccurate and unreliable, but it is the most biased, partisan, and prejudiced historical work I have ever read," he wrote. Lynch drew on his own experiences to defend Reconstruction. In addition to passing landmark civil rights laws, the integrated Mississippi legislature built new roads, hospitals, and schools, while instituting landmark reforms such as the first system of public education. The state governments under Reconstruction, quote, "were the best governments those states ever had before or have ever had since," end quote. Lynch argued because, quote, "they were the first and only governments in that section that were based upon the consent of the governed," end quote. But Lynch's defense of Reconstruction was overshadowed by the writings of white historians hostile to black suffrage, led by Columbia University historian William Archibald Dunning and his influential Ph.D. students, many of whom traveled from the South to study with him. They were the first generation of professional historians who produced seminal works on Reconstruction and detailed studies of each Southern state that defined how the era was understood for decades. The Dunning School provided, quote, "an intellectual foundation for Jim Crow." The Columbia University historian Eric Foner wrote, "This rewriting of history propelled the Lost Cause movement, led by Confederate veterans and their families, which promoted reconciliation efforts with the North by portraying the Civil War not as a fight to maintain slavery, but as a noble struggle to preserve the Southern way of life. As Reconstruction laws were wiped from the books, monuments were erected to Confederate generals throughout the South. The works of Rhodes and Dunning circulated widely, and the ultra-racist 1915 film, The Birth of a Nation, was a smash hit, becoming the first film shown at the White House and reviving the Ku Klux Klan. Quote, "The Southern victory over Reconstruction replaced Union victory in the war, and Jim Crow laws replaced the 14th Amendment in their places of honor in national memory," David Blight wrote in his piece Race and Reunion, The Civil War in American Memory. Lynch and his effort to preserve an accurate version of the history of Reconstruction have been largely forgotten. But as the country once again argues over its racial past, his work is arguably more important than ever. Next, along similar lines, this comes from the New York Times, a book review, nonfiction. The review was written by Jennifer Saleh, published May 1st, titled, She Wrote the History of White People. She has a lot more to say. I Just Keep Talking, a collection of essays and artwork by the historian Nell Irvin Painter, captures her wide-ranging interests and original mind. The book is titled I Just Keep Talking, A Life in Essays by Nell Irvin Painter. Pardon me, that is Nell Irvin Painter. As the historian Nell Irvin Painter has learned over the course of her 8 decades on this earth, inspiration can come from some unlikely places. In 2000, she happened across a news photograph of Grozny, the capital city of Chechnya, which had been bombed into rubble during the long stretch of devastating wars between Russia and the Caucasus. The photo prompted Painter to wonder how Caucasian became the term for white people. That, in turn, led her to the 18th-century German naturalist, who picked out 5 skulls to embody the 5, quote, varieties of mankind, what he deemed, quote, the really most beautiful form of skull, belonged to a young Georgian woman and would therefore represent Caucasians, whom he called the most beautiful and best formed of men. From a photograph of bombed-out Grozny to the absurd methodology of a German naturalist, Painter's research for the best-selling The History of White People in 2010 was born. Quote, it was as though I lost my head. You boiled off all the flesh and the brains and eyeballs out of it, and you called it New Jersey Variety of Mankind. She writes about the Georgian's skull in I Just Keep Talking, a collection of her essays and artwork that includes a number of such characteristically irreverent asides. Painter was an historian at Princeton before enrolling in art school at the age of 64. In 2018, she recalled the experience in a freewheeling memoir, I Just Keep Talking. I Just Keep Talking presents Painter in full, gathering personal reflections, scholarly essays, and images spanning several decades to convey the range of her interests and ambition. Painter writes, quote, so much in me was suited for disregard, end quote. She recalls a happy upbringing in Oakland by parents who, quote, were never poor, though never rich. The family would drive around California in their Kaiser automobile with Nell and her dog, Christopher Robin, stretched out on the back seat. She can see her class privilege for what it was, but it also made her feel as if she wasn't easily apprehensible by others. Quote, there's not much there in my life to match what my country likes to recognize as a black narrative of hurt, end quote. Painter went on to study that hurt in depth, writing about slavery's persistent legacy of violence. But she has also emphasized the historical importance of black resourcefulness and creativity. One of her books traced the exoduster migration of formerly enslaved people to Kansas in 1879. Another told the life story of the anti-slavery activist Sojourner Truth. Born enslaved, the charismatic Truth knew she had to be canny when it came to her self-presentation. One photograph she circulated included her statement, I sell the shadow to support the substance. This discrepancy between one's sense of self and how that self is received and remembered has long fascinated Painter. One essay in I Just Keep Talking explains why the line most associated with truth, "Aren't I a woman?" is something that truth almost certainly did not say. It was more probably the fabrication of a white anti-slavery writer who added the phrase in her account in order to portray truth as a, quote, colorful force of nature and amp up the drama. Painter doesn't deny that the theatricality was effective, dovetailing with truth's own deployment as a naive persona, but it also flattened her into a caricature, obscuring the quiddity of the woman she actually was. Quote, "My academic research as a black woman frequently loses out to a slogan that my sister citizens want truth to have said, and to the national hunger for simplifying history," end quote, Painter writes. Elsewhere, she explores how the 19th century abolitionist and Pan-Africanist Martin L. Delaney was claimed by black nationalists in the 1960s who ignored his adamant elitism. Delaney favored the immigration of black Americans to Liberia, where they would, quote, "assist to elevate the local population," which he described as, quote, "degraded brethren." As Painter points out, this was the attitude of someone who embraced the settler ideal. Delaney, quote, "could not conceive of policies that would benefit one group of blacks but not others," end quote. The essays in I Just Keep Talking show her repeatedly drawing attention to a plurality of black American experiences. An incisive 1989 review of the historian Eric Foner's Reconstruction criticizes him for paying insufficient attention to, quote, "women as autonomous actors, whose preferences did not always correspond to the demands of," quote, "their husbands or the market economy." A 1992 essay on the Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas and Anita Hill, who accused him of sexual harassment in congressional hearings before his appointment, is scathing on Thomas's disparagement of his own sister, whom he publicly derided as lazy and, quote, "dependent on welfare." Quote, "he seemed not to have appreciated that he was the favored boy child, protected and sent to private schools, and that she was the girl who stayed behind, married early, and cared for an ailing relative," end quote. Painter writes, going on to parse how Thomas, quote, "appropriated the figure of the lynch victim. Hill, by contrast, was a, quote, highly educated, ambitious black female Republican who had no comparable tradition of a stereotype that had been recognized, analyzed, and subverted to draw upon. As a result, she seemed to disappear," Painter says. The notion of disappearance is a preoccupation for Painter, who has spent enough time combing through the archives to see how easily entire lives get consigned to oblivion. She is candid about her frustrations with, quote, "stupid" reviews of her books and prize committees that she feels have, quote, "totally overlooked" her historical work. But seeking validation from elite institutions is too often a mug's game. Painter says that her practice as an artist allows her to explore a world that isn't tethered to, quote, "archival truth or clear meaning." During Donald Trump's presidency, her drawings and collages seemed to become looser and freer, gesturing at tragedy, but also inflected by her sly sense of humor. I Just Keep Talking is full of surprises, and it ends with something I haven't seen in a while: gratitude for social media. Facebook and Instagram felt like an abundance to her, especially during the isolation of the pandemic. Painter writes, quote, "I no longer feel as though I'm talking just to myself. Social media brought me lots of people to talk to who talked back," end quote. Our next article comes from CPR News. written by Tony Gorman, published May 8th. Black Men in White Coats hopes to inspire more black doctors. Caden Riley, a fifth grader at Blessed Sacrament Catholic School in Park Hill, loves basketball and therefore the Denver Nuggets, of course, baseball cap and all. But last Saturday, Riley was able to learn something a little different at the CU and Schultz Medical Campus. Medical procedures. Now the NBA lover wants to be a doctor. Riley was able to learn and even practice medical procedures as part of the Black Men in White Coats Youth Summit, an organization that seeks to increase the number of black men in the field of medicine through exposure, mainly aimed at K-12 students. Riley said, quote, "It was really fun, especially the one where you got to learn about how they do anesthesia and how to get the patient to breathe when they're asleep during surgery," end quote. Like most black children, Riley hasn't been around many black medical professionals. Last weekend, Black Men in White Coats partnered with medical schools across the country to hold youth summits. This was the group's second event at the CU School of Medicine. Desiree Thames has twin daughters at McAuliffe International School. They attended both CU gatherings. Thames said, quote, "Their own primary doctors have been predominantly white, but they've had an exposure to black doctors in professional settings. I have quite a few nurses in my family," end quote. But she says the event played a huge role in their interest in becoming doctors. She says one daughter is looking at physical therapy, and the other is interested in neuroscience or pediatrics. Thames said, quote, "We are lacking in this profession. They've never seen that for themselves. So when they are here and they hear that, they're kind of like, really?" End quote. About 500 elementary and middle school students registered for last Saturday's event. Students participated at various stations featuring anesthesia, emergency medicine, and physical therapy. Dr. Shanta Zimmer is the Senior Associate for Medical Education in the CU School of Medicine. She says part of the reason why black students aren't interested in the medical profession is because they do not see black role models in the field. Zimmer said, quote, "We have a long way to go to increase the number of black physicians. We know that having a diverse physician workforce actually improves the quality of care that we provide for patients in the communities. Communities of color in particular do better when there are physicians of color as well," end quote. Other event speakers included Denver area doctors Johnny Johnson and David Bruton. Johnson is a practicing OBGYN and president of the Mile High Medical Society. Bruton played for the Denver Broncos and Washington's NFL team, but now he practices physical therapy. According to the latest data from the Association of American Medical Colleges, only 5.7% of the medical professionals in the country identify as black or African American. Most of those doctors go into obstetrics and gynecology, preventative medicine, and child and adolescent psychiatry. At the CU School of Medicine, enrollment numbers for the 2024 spring semester included 255 students who identify as African American, or about 6%. The school also has 100 black physicians, 70 women, and 30 men. Dr. Dominique Royster is finishing up his four-year residency in anesthesia. Originally from England, he enlisted in the United States Air Force for 10 years as a surgical medic before going to medical school in Kansas City. He said he really never had a mentor in medicine from the African American community while growing up. Quote, "As a kid, seeing that you can do this as someone who looks like you is kind of inspiring," said Royster. "I think this is a good mentorship program of just getting contacts, because knowing someone who looks like you can definitely open doors. just because I've been through that struggle myself of not really having a black doctor to identify with. End quote. Letitia Nesby agrees. She attended the very first time with her two sons. They are both enrolled at Denver Science and Technology Conservation Green. As a parent, she felt her role is to expose her children to different cultures where the African-American community isn't predominant. Nurse Parminespi said, quote, "As parents, we expose them to people who look like them, who think like them, and who are from the same kind of backgrounds. I think that expands your success exponentially," end quote. If you would like to follow up on this group, blackmeninwhitecoats.org, where they have videos, quite a few of them, examples. The funniest med student you'll meet, Norman Harris II. The people's cardiologist, Dr. Eddie Hackler III. 50-year-old pastor goes to med school, Antonio Patterson. I became a doctor for my hood, making a difference in my hood, Dr. Abdullah Pratt. And my parents had a dream. I made it real. I always knew I'd become a doctor, by Dr. Brian Cryer. And there are more. These are videos available on the website www.blackmeninwhitecoats.org. Next, turning to Rocky Mountain PBS. This, written by Lindsay Ford, is published on May 11th. Deerfield. Deerfield once thrived in the plains of Colorado. A new effort plans to bring it back. Deerfield, Colorado. In 1910, black homesteaders settled into a community on the eastern plains of Weld County. They named Deerfield. It became one of the few self-sufficient homesteading communities for black Americans seeking opportunities in the West. Today, the Deerfield Preservation Committee hopes to turn what remains of the town, which is already on the National Register of Historic Places, into a National Historic Site. Doing so would place Deerfield under the protection of the U.S. Park Service, who would impose tighter preservation regulations and provide more support. The National Register of Historic Places designation, in contrast, is largely honorary. Quote, "To own your own land and to be able to farm it and make money and pass down to your family and so forth, that was an ideal situation," end quote, said George Jun, who is part of the Deerfield Preservation Committee and a professor of Africana Studies at the University of Northern Colorado. According to the National Park Service, black settlers of the American West tended to homestead in, quote, colonies to pool resources between families. After the 1866 Civil Rights Act opened up homesteading to black Americans, 3,500 claimants succeeded in obtaining titles from the General Land Office, researchers found. Altogether, black homesteaders owned roughly 650,000 acres of land across the West. Roughly 15,000 people lived in these communities, with Deerfield becoming one of the largest. Of the six largest black homesteads in Nicodemus, Kansas, Sully County, South Dakota, DeWitte, Nebraska, Empire, Wyoming, and Blackdom, New Mexico, only Nicodemus survives as a town. Although it's no longer inhabited, Deerfield is the only other black homestead with buildings that are still standing, according to the National Park Service. Oliver T., for Toussaint Louverture, Jackson, a black entrepreneur born in 1862 to parents who escaped enslavement, founded the town. Jackson promoted land ownership and homesteading to black Americans, aiming to create wealth and a haven free from racial discrimination and economic hardship. Dr. Joseph H. P. Westbrook, a black physician in Denver, gave the town its name at an organizational meeting in 1909. He proclaimed that the fields, quote, will be very dear to us, thus giving Deerfield its name. In 1921, 15,000 of the community's 20,000 acreage were used for farming and livestock grazing. Between 1919 and 1923, Deerfield had between 100 and 200 full-time or part-time residents and up to 70 families. According to the Weld County Historical Record, the town's net worth that year was appraised at $1,075,000. Jun said, quote, Deerfield was an area where black people could live and not have to worry about things and settle down, end quote. The Black American West Museum and Heritage Center in Denver today owns 80% of Deerfield and is part of the Preservation Committee, along with local government, nonprofit organizations, and the University of Northern Colorado. The remaining owners are private families. It is unclear if these owners have any ties to the Deerfield settlers. The Deerfield Preservation Committee hopes to start working towards rehabilitation and restoration through grants and state funds. The committee has yet to determine the exact cost of the restoration. Quote, I come from the position of an archaeologist and an historian, and I think that the better you understand our past, and when I say our, I mean all of our past, the better the future will be, end quote, said Bob Brunswig, another member of the Preservation Committee and a retired University of Northern Colorado archaeology professor. One of the leading restoration goals is stabilizing Jackson's home, which is located in the heart of downtown Deerfield. With additional plans to turn the, quote, filling station, the only gas station in town, into a visitor center. Cleaning out his home in 2022, Richard Boris, a Greeley antiques dealer, came across his wife's history collection containing five ledger books detailing Deerfield's expenses and private loans, all written by Jackson in pencil. Boris knew about Jackson's significance to Deerfield and subsequently donated the ledgers to the Greeley History Museum. Quote, the beauty of this project is that things literally turn up out of the woodwork, end quote, said Chris Bowles, manager of the City of Greeley Museum. Jackson chronicled his life expenditures and business activities in the ledgers. These included his management of the Chautauqua Hotel in Boulder in 1898 and his various loans to Deerfield residents who didn't have enough money to put down on their homesteads. In 1910, the Deerfield lots cost between $10 to $25, which would equal $788 in 2024, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Other details from the ledgers include which town folk used the one phone in Deerfield, who they were contacting, and how many times they called. There were also letters preserved in the ledgers. One was from a woman in the 1920s who took up work at a farm in Rogan, Colorado. In the letter, the woman wrote she believed that her letters were being read by the farmers and others. She finished her correspondence with, quote, I don't mind work, but I hate slavery, end quote. The word hate was underlined three times. Bowles said he doesn't believe many documents countrywide detail a black colony of the early 20th century in such detail. Despite its success, Deerfield became a ghost town after the Dust Bowl, severe dust storms that significantly damaged agricultural ecology, and also the Great Depression. The combined disasters devastated the town's finances. Quote, I am really moved by the scale of what O.T. Jackson was trying to achieve, and he was very nearly successful if it wasn't for the Dust Bowl and the Great Depression, end quote, said Bowles. The Dust Bowl decimated the High Plains, making Deerfield no longer viable as an agricultural community. Residents started moving out during the Great Depression, and by 1940, only two homesteaders remained. Many houses, which widely lacked foundations, were sold or collapsed. June said, quote, "Homes were built pretty much on the ground. They had maybe some bricks and other materials under them," end quote. June said Jackson remained undeterred and was starting a new phase to rebuild his town. He hired a man to start plowing fields, but while the man was working, documents show a plow went through his chest and killed him. Jackson finally gave up on Deerfield after the man of hire's death. Said June, quote, "O.T. Jackson lived in Deerfield as long as he could," end quote. Jackson stayed in Deerfield until 1942 when his wife died and moved to Greeley once his health became too poor, said June. The founder died in Greeley in 1948 and was buried in the Lynn Grove Cemetery. Brunswick said, quote, "The more that we become acquainted with Deerfield's past and all of these varied ways that we're trying to understand it, it's telling the story of a people who lived such interesting and challenging lives," end quote. Volunteers behind the preservation push hope to have an official answer about Deerfield's National Historic Site protections by 2025. And that brings me to the end of our time for this week. Thank you so much for joining us. This was the Black Experience Hour.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.